The Veritas Radio Network is guaranteed the right to offend, annoy, agitate, shout, heresy, and entertain.
You should start programming right now.
Kind of like the cultural sewage served up on Bravo or CMT, only it's on 24 hours a day, except Sundays. When the truth gets you angry and you throw your smartphone, remember, no one is forcing you to listen to the truth on the Veritas Radio Network.
You can't handle the truth.
You're doing that of your own free will. That's what makes this country great, and any gay marriage pointless.
That's offensive.
So there isn't much you can do about it, Chowderhead.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Grab a book, take a vow, and conform your mind to reality. Otherwise, you're just another Judas-inspired Karl Marx wannabe.
And your children will steal your credit card number to buy tickets to the Miley Cyrus Twerkers Ball.
I came in like a wrecking ball.
Are you ready? Let's get it on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
Such a melodic score that the motion picture soundtrack theme to Lawrence of Arabia, in case you were wondering. This is the Crusade Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network, radio the way it should be. This is episode number 17 of the Modern Wrong World Made Right, Calvin Was Wrong series. Today, we will conclude Volume 1 and Volume 2 of St. Robert Bellarmine's work on the controversy of the Roman Pontiff and set up our conversation. And we'll continue after this on Bellarmine's work on the Antichrist. So, we've been at this for 16 weeks, folks, and boy, have we learned an awful lot. And we have explored and plumbed to the depths, as they say, all of the charges that were leveled by Martin Luther, Illyricus, John Calvin, and other Protestant reformers at the invalidity, the imbecility, the deceit, and the fraud, all alleged, that make up what we call the office of the Pope or the Pontificate today. And all these charges, as we have learned, were all refuted one by one by one man at St. Robert Bellarmine. And he wrote all of his responses down. And what we have learned is that we have witnessed an absolute magnificent tour de force of the history of the history of the popes, basically, and of how they came to be and how the office came to be, how it formed, how the traditions formed, how there was separation between the West and the East, how the office arrived at Rome, how the seat remains in Rome, all of it. And all of it proven, demonstrated through the use of the demonstrable historical record. Which means we really have not had a theological discussion about this. This has all been based upon whether or not any of the claims made by Calvin and Luther et al. Could be proven or disproven. And as we have learned, the history has proven that Calvin and Luther and the Illyricus and the rest of them were making things up as they went along, were just hurling charges at the whoever it was that was answering the charges, because it wasn't known to them at the time that it was just St. Robert Bellarmine. And we have learned here that there is quite a body of actual history that remains to this day, in most of it in extant form, some of it in tradition, that backs up the divine case for the office of the Holy Roman Pontiff. And it's been a fascinating conversation. We're just at the end of the book now. And so let's bring on our special guest, our Latinist translator from MediatrixPress.com. It's MediatrixPress.com Press.com. Ryan Grant, who has been with us for all 16 previous episodes, and we'll wrap up today's with the discussion on Chapter 31. Ryan, welcome to, I guess this is our season finale for this phase of the project. How are you?
Not bad, thank you. And you?
I am well. I'm excited to get to Chapter 31, which is, I believe, where we left off, and to wrap all this up and perhaps recap, and then tie the whole thing together, and then maybe give a preview of the next volume that we'll get into, which will continue the series, called The Antichrist. Although I must ask, because I haven't delved into The Antichrist, because I've been reading this one, will we still go with the title Calvin Was Wrong, or is this a new set of reformers that is the target, or that he is responding to?
It's the same one, and he also incorporates some other Protestants that he had not referenced very much, or really who weren't at all that important in the scheme of things, but made rather impudent or ridiculous arguments. So for the sake of part of it for comic relief, part of it to absolutely demolish the point of the opponent, he'll bring them in. And the focus of the scope of Antichrist, it's mostly Calvin. So, I mean, for the sake of the motif, we can, you know, focus almost exclusively on where he addresses Calvin. Mostly because the only other one worthy of response in this particular area is Illyricus and Luther.
Right.
So a lot of it deals with Calvin. He has many, many chapters dealing with Calvin's teaching on this subject. So,
and why don't we recap? Because it's a long way from where we began way back in October or in early November. Actually, you and I began in September or so, but we had a little bit of a delay. A little bit of a sabbatical, if you will, while things were working themselves out here. So we began this, though, in earnest in the, I believe in December of 2015. And we began with the De Romano Pontifici, book number one on the ecclesiastical monarchy of the Roman Pontiff. And the first question that was proposed is, what might be the best system of government? And I think it might be fascinating to just recap, if you would, for just a moment here, that we actually began this conversation about the Pope and about his divinity and about the validity of his office with a discussion first, which is not a theological one, but is a practical one, one that we may be well to have today. And that's Bellarmine's exploration of what is the best form of government. Why don't you give the listeners a bit of a recap, because it's been a while since we covered that.
Well, certainly. It begins with the question of the ecclesiastical monarchy of the Roman Pontiff. That's what Book 1 is about altogether. So in order to postulate a theological proposition, you have to have a philosophical foundation. And that's why there's the explanation for why this is so is, well, look, monarchy is the best system of government. He goes through Aristotle, the ancient philosophers, to explain this. And again, which is mostly refuting John Calvin, because Calvin's philosophy and theology of the church, as explicated in the Institutes, is rather of a decentralized church that has presbyters' councils, priests that are, they're not priests in an ordained ministerial sense. They're presbyters in the sense of the Greek word presbyteroi, which is elders.
Okay.
And they are the judges of whether or not you are interpreting the word of God. So it is its own little that's being created, but it's, you know, decentralized. centralized, and it's just in name only, who's kind of assisting it, but it's all done in the presbyters' councils. And so therefore, and the reason for that is aristocracy, according to Calvin, is really the best form of government, not monarchy. I mean, mostly because he's trying to cut off any argument whereby one would arrive at a need for a universal bishop over the church. So Bellarmine refutes that first by showing philosophically why monarchy is in fact the best form of government. And he shows it in two senses. One is objectively, without the conditions of this world, simply an absolute monarchy where one guy is in charge and everyone obeys, that's perfect. Because without the circumstances of this world, he would never be a tyrant, he would never be unjust, he would never do anything but order all things rightly. And then, you know, the order and the hierarchy would reflect God and everyone would be happy. But since we do have the circumstances of this world, our fallen human nature and other things, therefore it's necessary that the monarchy, as Bellarmine says, arguing almost purely from Aristotle and the Politics at this point,
right?
But also defending it from St. Thomas and from the scholastic philosophers in St. Augustine, is that the monarchy has to be tempered or mixed with aristocracy, elements of aristocracy, and with even democracy at certain levels. And that's essentially what St. Thomas says in De Regno, or De Regimine, I'm sorry, on ruling. He talks at length about this, and so that like a local elective assembly, that is democracy on a small scale, makes sense at that level, but within the stability provided by a monarch. Right? So in any event, so Bellarmine prefaces all this to just give the basis that the monarchy is that's the way it runs best, right? And even from the ancients, you know, one guy should be in charge of managing all these different things in a state. Well, if that's true in the state, how much more is it in the church, which God established? Would not God establish the best possible system, you know, for the church to run by? And that's what essentially is the preparation is. So after having laid the foundation, now let's move to the church. And it's especially a potent argument in the 16th century because most men at that time, very few, would deny that a king should be over a state, including Calvin. So that becomes, even though Calvin argues aristocracy is the best system of government, and he lives in Switzerland, of course, you know, he would never deny the authority of a prince in his state or think how things should work a certain way and whatnot. You have, it didn't stop the Protestants from trying to get the Archbishop of Cologne to switch to Lutheranism so as to get, a Protestant elector to then establish a Protestant emperor, you know, in the Holy Roman Empire. And Calvin was entirely in support of that. So nevertheless, that's why they do it. So now the head of should the church run by a monarchy or by an aristocracy? Well, if God established the church, why wouldn't the church use the best system of government? So then he goes to an exegetical commentary that means a treatise on the text of Matthew 16:18, as well as other ones such as John 21. Is there a monarchy that Christ established for the church? And then he argues exegetically based on the Greek, based on so many things, that this is in fact the case. And that it's actually Peter to whom Jesus said, I give thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven, etc. What the keys mean. Right, and you see it even in ancient times, you see it in the Old Testament, and you also see it even in his time,
right,
where you give the key to the city to somebody, right, and that signifies, you know, giving a certain, you know, like actually what it really signifies is submission, okay, and even there's even like in that time, there's a famous painting of Velazquez, who's the famous painter, is a friend of Peter Paul Rubens, and another two, you know, good Catholic painters. Well, I mean, Velazquez had his moral problems, but in terms of his philosophy, he was a very good Catholic painter. He painted the surrender of Breda during the 80 Years' War between the Spanish and the Dutch, where the Dutch had surrendered Breda. And so the Nassau, the Dukes of Nassau who ran Breda, were handing over the keys to Spinola, this Italian general fighting for the Spanish. And then Spinola is receiving the keys. And you can look this up, surrender of Breda, and you'll see the picture, the painting, to see that. So he's handing over the keys to the city to show we are giving the authority over this place to the Spaniards, right? You know, so as the, and that's what that means. That's what the symbol, and it comes from the Old Testament. That's where that symbol comes from. It's not a Roman thing, right? It's simply something that is found in Israel under David. David gave the keys to his prime minister. So then he shows that Peter is the visible head in place of Christ while he's gone. And he doesn't mention it in the book, but it's part of Catholic theology that when the last judgment happens, there won't be any more popes in the New Jerusalem. That's it. Christ will resume the visible headship of the church, just as he's the invisible head, and the pope is the visible one.
You know, what's the fascinating thing about the key argument is that when you go to buy a new house and you go to closing, and after you've done all the 800 billion signatures on closing documents that you have to sign these days, when you're finished and the documents and checks are handed over and exchanged and everything, what do they give you? Keys.
They give you the keys.
When you go to buy a car, if you go to buy a car at a car dealership, Ryan, let's just say you walked in off the street and your friend dropped you off because you knew you were going to buy a car or finance it, pay cash or whatever. When the last piece of the documents are signed and the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, when they transfer the vehicle to you, what do they transfer it with?
The keys.
Keys. So, the tradition even to this day, Ryan, is carried forth. So it's obviously a very old tradition that just naturally denotes a changing of or a granting of ownership, a granting of custody. It's just fascinating that people can still deny this today, but they don't deny how they take possession of their houses or their cars.
And then the rest of the book one is taken with what we call in rhetoric the argument, in logic, the argument as to the effects. That is, the effects also prove what we have already placed as a foundation.
Right.
So then you have the whole church is signified by, you know, the words "my sheep" in John 21. And he also goes in a long commentary in the Greek and how the church fathers have read it. And always in his argumentation, it's copious references to the scripture. And then the church fathers, both the Greek fathers and the Latin fathers, then to the tradition. So that he'll even reach out to the fathers going all the way into the 11th century. So that's like the Benedictine abbot Rupert, or St. Bernard of Clairvaux, and then, of course, the Venerable Bede, too, who's always a major source amongst the fathers. He's also a doctor of the church, 8th century or so, St. Bede. So these are, you know, so that's the style of argumentation. So then he continues on to the prerogatives of Peter, and which there's quite a few. And so these are all, you know, shown in the scriptures. So he points them out. He points out, well, in this case, Peter did this. And in this case, you know, Christ did this for Peter. And all these different symbols that show, you know, he is always the prominent person that's you know, aforementioned. He's the one who has all these special gifts and prerogatives. And then he answers all the objections, both from Calvin and from the aforementioned Illyricus, Matthew Flavowitz, who is a Lutheran. And, of course, everyone at that time took up trade names. Even Calvin, his actual name in French is Jean Calvin. And it's Latinized to Calvinus. And that's how we get Calvin. And of course, Luther was his own right name, his Christian name, rather than whatever it was as a monk. So the... But you know, other guys took these, so it's because Flavowitz is from Dalmatia, which today we call the Balkans.
Okay.
In classical times, it was called Illyria. He took the name Illyricus. And then there's other figures, too. Johannes Musch took the name Oecolampadius. He put it in a Greek form. Another famous Protestant, he had his center of influence at Basel. The Oecolampadius, for example, wrote a terribly dishonest book about the Eucharist where he had changed what the church fathers had said, actually inserted his own words into their quotes, or actually omitted quotes where they clearly taught the Blessed Sacrament. It was John Fisher with a 220,000-word reply that, of course, half of that's quoting Oecolampadius, but anyway, demolishing and showing from the clear citations that all people agreed from and all the additions that, you know, he was just a completely dishonest scholar, at least in that book. Right, because he had a reputation as being a great humanist, but when it came to that book, he completely tried to pull the wool over the eyes of the less learned, and Fisher caught him. It is a brilliant book, actually, although it can be very tedious for a modern to read, even if you know Latin very well. So anyway, so that's how the book one ends. Answering all these objections, especially the centurions try to show all these sins that Peter did. So obviously those were put there to make sure we wouldn't reverence Peter too much, which is not the case at all. So then it comes to book two, which we are concluding which is the successors of the Supreme Pontiff. So he starts out by arguing against a book by Ulrich Vilenus. And Vilenus had written in the 1520s, trying to argue that, well, it's historically certain that Peter never went to Rome. And so he makes all this argumentation. So then Bellarmine starts and takes each argument apart from the testimony of the scripture primarily, and then also the church fathers, to show very clearly that they had been in Rome, and he had been a bishop in Rome. And all the fathers accept that.
Right.
So then, so it demolishes all the different arguments of this Vilenus, and then gives this tribute to the holy martyr John Fisher that we just noted last week, where he had he said, you know, if only I could get my hands on Fisher's book for its most celebrated defense, right? Because Fisher, even then, was one of the most famous theologians in Christendom, especially because of his staunch defense of the church and losing his head for it under Henry VIII. So nevertheless, then he proceeds to more evidence that the Pope succeeds, that the Roman Pontiff succeeds Peter in this ecclesiastical monarchy that he demonstrated in Book 1, which comes from the testimony of the Greek and Latin fathers, from archaeology. The tombs of the apostles are here in their reverence, and all these fathers mention them. From the list, the diptych that church fathers kept in the ancient church, because that's how you show that your church was an apostolic church.
Okay.
That had the right to rule from Christ and the apostles, and it's set out from its founding bishop who either was an apostle or was constituted by an apostle. And so all the churches, and that's how we have apostolic succession, so all these churches could trace themselves back to, you know, essentially to the Roman pontiff. When you get down to it, Bellarmine's argumentation is correct, that Peter alone was made a bishop by Christ, and then Peter made all the other apostles bishops. So, however that worked, Rome is clearly listed by Irenaeus and by all these fathers as having, you know, it's beginning with Peter, and then, you know, the popes going down as they're named in the Roman canon. And then finally, you know, from law, that you only see that from the pope, you know, there's no appeal. And that, but not from any other bishop, and that the laws, you know, the Pope always has the right to dispense the laws, but he respects the rights given to the other patriarchs and to the other areas of the church, so that, you know, he's not trying to, because it'd be impossible to bureaucratically manage every last darn thing going on in the church all around the world, especially
That's
in
right.
those times when everything's going by boat, and it, depending on the wind,
yeah.
it's the wrong time of year. It might take you a very long time to get around
a
to
a very
where you're
long
going.
Time, I would imagine.
Quite a bit. And then you know, even letters, mail service at different points, especially in the early papacy, depending on what was going on in the empire, letter service, especially when during the period of persecution. You know, you might really have a great difficulty getting around. So then, you know, and as things continue, that the, you know, the popes very clearly write letters are expected to be obeyed. Councils address the popes. They say, you know, Peter has spoken through Leo, that is Pope Leo the Great. The Council of Chalcedon says that. And they're acknowledging Leo as the successor of Peter. And the same thing for... In a later council, Pope Agatho. They say Peter has spoken through Agatho. So all of these things come together. And then lastly, we hit this question of whether what could happen if the Pope became a manifest heretic. Would he lose his office? And as we'd addressed that very copiously last time, what that actually means, what goes on if you know, what has to happen if the Pope would become a manifest heretic. So it actually it takes on all these different arguments,
and we learn
one of which.
Yeah,
I
was going to say we learn in that he can't be a heretic because by definition, then he wouldn't be a pope because he would even be a Catholic. So I was
right.
just going to insert just because of today's date that today, Ryan, in your translation of the work, I don't know if you ever counted or have an estimate, but we did run across the name Saint Irenaeus many many times, and today is his feast day.
That's right. Irenaeus is a Greek father. He's taken as because he originally wrote in Greek, mm-hmm. and he lived in Lyon in France. At that time, the Roman name for it is Lutetenses. And he had written a work against heresies. We're mostly writing against the Gnostic heresy. And he's about 180 AD
right.
or so. And he is he writes in there in Book 3 that it is necessary for all churches to agree with the Roman Church, this one church, on account of a mightier preeminence that it has over all the rest. So that's 180 AD. So that's before, right, you know, the whole Constantine thesis. Sorry,
that's right.
And it's not just because the so-called all roads lead to Rome, especially in the East. It's really because that's where Peter had established the primacy. Because the reason all roads lead to Rome is so the Romans can more quickly exact tax money coming out of people. But it was not necessarily easier to get, you know, if you were a private person, to send messages to Rome or get to Rome. And in actuality, you know, especially in the East, it was a lot easier to communicate in the East. So that's why Pope Clement I, in about 80 AD, you know, the Corinthians write to him.
That's right.
Asking for guidance, whereas in, you know, John the Apostle is alive in Ephesus, right? Who the heck is Clement? He's a freed slave that there was Peter's secretary. But John the Apostle was there at the crucifixion. He's the apostle that reclined with Christ at the Last Supper. Don't you think that he would know a lot more than this Greek freed slave Clement about who Jesus was? But they write anyway.
And not only that, Ryan, but
rather than Ephesus, which is much closer, much easier to write to, because it was also the Roman imperial center for Asia Minor, what we now call Turkey.
And I was just going to add, not only that, but St. Irenaeus was a student of, a disciple, if you will, of St. Polycarp. St. Polycarp is one of my favorite saints because the biography written about him by Alban Butler, and I've read it many, many times, what a story that is. And St. Polycarp was a disciple of the aforementioned St. John the Evangelist. So you have a very, very clear chain of right there of St. John the Evangelist or the Apostle to St. Polycarp and then to St. Irenaeus. And St. Irenaeus, as I said, is mentioned many times in our work. And that brings us, I think that's a really good recap, and that's that brings us to the 25-minute mark. Why don't we take our time out by setting up what we're going to discuss in the next segment here, and we'll conclude Volume 2, which is that the Roman Pontiff succeeds Peter in the ecclesiastical monarchy is proven from the names which Roman Pontiffs are usually given. And this is a fascinating chapter. I read it this morning, and I can't wait to hear your take on this, and I'm sure the audience can't either. So why don't we do that, and then we'll talk about getting into the next phase of our project here, which will be into the Antichrist book. Folks, this is The Modern Wrong World Made Right. Calvin Was Wrong, episode number 17. We are here live. This is the Crusade Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network, radio the way it should be.